Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour. This is for August 16th, 2018. This month marks 2 years since I began my paid casts. And that was at the request of the audience. They said, you know, why don't you do special series on scientific topics? Because my radio show, I include, like tonight, I'll be talking a little bit about Monsanto. These are current issues. And then also the fact that alternative radio, which is now really the mainstream radio and programming, we're not reaching kids. I try to talk to kids and families. I know there's a lot of families that listen to my show regularly because I talk a lot about education. I talk about kids sitting down, you know, parents get the phone away, get the TV, the tablets, whatever, and sit down, not with a computer, but with paper and pencil, and start to write. You're much more creative. Imagine a painter like, say, Leonardo or any painter. And imagine that they only used a computer to paint. Would you get that human touch into the painting? Well, of course not. And when I studied, say, physics, mathematics, I would go into a problem and I would draw pictures and I'd try and understand it from a visual point of view, relating that to the equations. And you can only do that by hand. You can only do that, so turn off the computer. Turn off all of the distractions, the telephone ringing. You need hours and hours, and we really have to improve science and math education in the United States. And the first thing you have to do is get an attention span for the kids. And you're not going to do this with all of those distractions, with music playing. Your brain, believe me, your brain cannot get into those deep states of thought with distractive noises, music, television in the other room, somebody. When I was in high school, when I was young and I started to realize I'm pretty good at math and physics, etc., it just so happened that my father had worked at the post office and they were remodeling and they were like just going to throw out all of this old, the desks, the big, big old, that probably been there for 50 years or something. And so anyway, he made arrangements to bring one home, hauled it upstairs, put it in my room. And that was my desk, my work desk. But where I grew up in the winter time in Minnesota, I was up on the second floor in the corner in my bedroom with this big desk with kind of filing. It was very nice. I had all kinds of filing up above because it was a post office desk. And so and a big flat surface that had been used a lot. So we put down a piece of very hard fiberboard. I don't know if they even make that. I don't see it in the lumber yards anymore, but it was very hard, very, not real thick, but really hard. So you put that on the top, and that made a very good surface to work on. So there was this big desk where I could lay out all my work and things, but I did it by hand. I had pens and paper, and I always had a stack of paper there. I still work like this. People laugh at me because I have my notes and people kid it with me. They say, don't forget to make notes about making your notes because I live in a world that's really complicated with so many aspects, hundreds and thousands, if not more, aspects of details that, so everything's written down and the progression of my research, etc. So notes are very important, but when you're doing problems or physics problems or math, you have to draw pictures. You have to get a visual understanding. You have to learn to draw in three dimensions and understand how things fit together. And this only comes with a lot of time. So the reason I've met students in other countries where, for example, I've met some Russian students, and they don't even look at TV. They've never owned a TV. They will look at TV maybe on the weekend with the family. Some show is on and they'll sit down. But that's it. They don't distract themselves at all. And so that's why those other countries are advancing. So we have to get back in general in the United States to good study habits. So anyway, just a little offshoot there, but 2 years since I began my paid casts, and I've covered such a wide range of topics. You can go on my webpage, just click on the link at the very top of the page. There's a couple links. There's one to the sales page for water filters, my books. And then there's a link for the paid cast sign-up page, which down below has a list of the weekly topics going back for the past 2 years. And now, of course, I am involved in giving lectures on my books. So this is something that is really fun for me. I've completed the lectures for the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book, the Surviving Planet X Passage book, the Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book, and now I just started in August. I started on the weather book, the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather. And remember that these books were written for you, the general public. And I can tell you that high-level scientists also read these. But my goal was to take my work, which is very complicated, and I can be in a room, and I have been in a room with 50 top plasma physicists, for example, at Los Alamos. I've been given invited talks at Los Alamos National Laboratories on my work. And, 50 high-level plasma physicists in a room at one time, and I'm talking about my work. So I can talk at that level, but I can also, most people that are scientists, you put them on a radio, you put them in front of a microphone, and they start to drool. You know, nothing makes sense that all they can do is think on this ultra abstract, esoteric level that they live in. Well, I'm not like that. I learned how to teach. I was always a member of the real world. You know, I taught at many different levels, but I have an ability to communicate. So these books were written for the general public so you can understand the misconceptions that are being promoted and what's really true about outer space and Earth weather. But the weather book, just a little side note, the weather book is about 300 pages long. It started at around 600 pages, and I thought, you know, this is ridiculous. I cannot print a 600-page book about weather and space weather for the general public. Not many people are going to buy it. It's going to be really expensive to print, and not many people would buy it, and fewer people would read it. So I had to pare it down considerably. And so it's down to under 300 pages, and that was one of the most difficult processes of my life, trying to figure out what not to include so that it was a very well-rounded book. Okay, so anyway, now I'm talking in my paid cast about the weather book. I suggest that also if you join the paid cast, you can get my ebook library for a very low price, and also buy, of course, all of the paid casts going back 2 years now at a very, I think it's like $35, so it's really a good deal. It's like, normally it's $3.95 a month, but you can get the subscription plus extra books. Anyway, it's starting to sound like an advertisement, but anyway, I'm very proud of the paid casts. So you get an extra hour every week of pure scientific topics without the other, you know, current events type things going on. Okay, well, now I mentioned Monsanto, so let me do a little kind of tirade on this. Monsanto every now and then gets a fine, like from the EPA. One of the recent stories was they were selling cottonseed in Texas that was laced with insecticide. And so, it was killing bugs. The chemicals in the seed would leach into the ground and kill insects, and it was banned. So anyway, Monsanto had to pay $2 million or $2.5 million or something like this. But as we know, when a company like Monsanto puts the price on its product, it has already cut a deal with the Environmental Protection Agency and says, okay, now here's a product. If you fine us on this product, how much are you going to charge us? And the EPA comes back, who is, you know, part of the revolving door process here, Washington and big corporations. And the EPA will come back and say, well, we'll charge you $2.5 million if you get caught. And so when Monsanto gets caught, the EPA does this big investigation, comes back, charges them $2.5 million. Well, hey, guess what? Monsanto already has that money from the sale of the product that they shouldn't have been selling. Already have the money because they put that into the price of the product. And so then, okay, here's your $2.5 million. It's like when I was a kid, there were stories that used to read, something people don't do anymore, but they were the Uncle Remus stories. And Uncle Remus was a black guy that lived down south, and his favorite characters were Br'er Rabbit was his favorite character. Anyway, they're wonderful kid stories, but the one of the primary things was that they were always trying to find, Br'er Rabbit was always outsmarting the farmer. And so anyway, they threw him into the briar patch, and Br'er Rabbit says, no, please don't throw me into that briar patch there. And so anyway, they throw him into the briar patch, and he's going, ooh, ow, and they're standing outside thinking that Br'er Rabbit is really, really getting punished. And Br'er Rabbit is inside laughing because his favorite place is in the briar patch. So anyway, that's what Monsanto is. You know, when these fines come out, everybody, ooh, $2.5 million. Well, if they charge you $2.5 million, that would be a big thing. But charging Monsanto $2.5 million, that's like you paying a penny or half a penny. How about a third of a penny? Okay, you're charged a third of a penny fine. Oh my goodness, here I'll give you the whole penny because it's too much work to cut it in three pieces. That's the type of fines that go to Monsanto. It's a joke. It's absurd. Anyway, okay. So enough of that. The California fires, I've been asked to discuss this and ask my people ask me my opinion if I think they're set. Well, there's a lot of people going around saying that the fires were set. When the, say, the Kilauea volcano was going off, there were people saying that it was ignited by a fracking power plant that was right at the location of the caldera, in which they had been basically pumping cold water down into the volcano for years. And that water would go into the ground, and then it would come back as steam, and they would capture the energy from that steam and then convert it into electricity. And I didn't realize this, just in reading articles in the newspaper, it said that that provided 20% of the energy on the island, and that there were this was one of three such installations operated and owned by Harry Reid and his partners. I think another one was in California. I can't remember where the other one was. But they have since shut down all of these because they've realized this is a bad idea. But in terms of, let me just put it this way. I'm a scientist. When I talk about weather manipulation and the fact that certain storms were manipulated, it's because I have scientific evidence. It's not just because I'm like shooting off my mouth one day. It's because I have scientific evidence that these particular storms had very distinct signatures of manipulation. And there's people running around, jumping up and down, oh, every storm is manipulated, all this, and, you know, the issue, getting back to the fires in California, I personally don't have data, scientific data, that would lead me to be able to say that these fires had been started. Now, I've seen pictures, but remember that in most courts of law, photos and videos are no longer accepted as evidence. That's because, that's why you see like this latest political snafu with some lady from the White House, you know, giving audio tapes. And there was some cases previously where there were audio tapes. And they realized that these audio tapes were second generation and doctored. And you could tell that they were, experts would examine them, etc. So the bottom line is that photos, audio tapes, videotapes, videos are not allowed as evidence because of the ability to Photoshop and fake. And it's rather funny that I cannot post on YouTube that if somebody puts a blog note favorable to me, so listen to James McCanney on this, it's immediately taken down. But there are YouTube videos that take pieces of my radio show from back in the early 2000s, cut them apart, piece them together, and those are allowed and promoted on YouTube. They're actually, which is total disinformation. So anyway, I personally don't have data, and I have not seen any data. I've seen pictures, I've seen videos where it looks like a laser beam is coming down from the sky and starting a fire. I've heard personal accounts of people, literally people that I know, that have seen fires start up in the West Coast area, where they were like right next to it, and all of a sudden there's a fire, but they had no indication that it would be some kind of energy beam from above type of deal. They did not see anything. And by the way, when, say, a laser or the type of energy beams that are capable of doing this kind of starting fires, you would not see them. It's not like you'd look over and see this Scotty beam me up type of beam coming down from the sky. You would not see anything. And I've, back in my early career, when I was confirming that laser satellites were inducing cyclonic storms out in the ocean, I actually went up in airplanes and took photos that were where I could see the pulsing of, and these come in pulses, not like a beam, like a tractor beam, or, you know, like I say, Star Wars or whatever, or, you know, in the movies. It's not what it would look like. So I really cannot say, but what I would say is the circumstantial evidence, the drought, the ongoing drought, that certainly I confirmed many years ago was man-manipulated. The West Coast droughts were being forged by a manipulation technique where they would keep the storm systems from coming in off the Pacific Ocean. So to set these fires, and it seems like they're strategically located to burn people out of certain areas. Now, I talked before, it was like, what, a year or two ago, the fires up in the, in fact, the Hammond Ranch, that was part of it, where the, it was well known that the Bureau of Land Management and the FBI and possibly the United Nations, we don't know all the people that were up there, a lot of black trucks, but they were literally starting fires to burn the ranchers off their land, including their cattle and their houses. What a horrific, horrific thing to do. And that was over the uranium fields, because those uranium fields they wanted for the Uranium One sale that was the backdoor Clinton deal. Also Saskatchewan and Alberta, the region up there, high uranium content. The uranium was in the ground, and so they had to, it's like strip mining. It's a very shallow strip mining type of process to get the uranium out that then is processed into uranium. So they literally burned those people out and told them to leave and not come back. They literally burned these people off their property to get at that uranium. So that just gives you an idea how ruthless these people are. But that was a case where it was very clear that those fires were set by people, by government agencies, etc., who were after the uranium. Okay. So, but I personally don't have evidence that the California fires were set. But the one thing I'm going to tell you is when you see the destruction, or the destruction in Greece, oh my goodness, the road was burning. Everything burned. When you see these towns, the cars are all burned. These fires came raging through with hurricane force winds that just stoked them up to the, and they moved very quickly, and the people had to run into the ocean to get away. They said the water was burning. So something really wrong was going here. Something very definitely man-created, man-made, or whatever was going on in these fires in Greece, because that was just too much. I mean, it was absolutely too much. And when you looked at it, there were like big areas, like parking lots, that were burnt to a crisp. And there were a lot of areas where there was nothing to burn that were burned to a crisp. It was almost like the fire bombings at Dresden or something at that level, where literally everything burned. All the cars, the roads, the curbs, the houses, everything. Those people were simply burned completely out of there. So that makes you think that there was something more going on there. Well, you know, and of course there were dry conditions, granted. But when people are out in the ocean, and the trees were not that big, there was more like shrubs. You know, and of course a lot of the California shrubs are that way. When the fires come through, it's not big trees. They're, you know, plants and yard plants and things like that. And of course they can burn, but what people are saying, and this is coming from experts, is that these fires are much hotter than a typical fire that you would expect from natural causes, even given that the conditions are very dry, etc. Okay, so enough of that, but to say that these were started with satellites, there are a lot of ways to start fires. You don't need satellites to start fires. That could be a method. Pictures don't prove that. If someone saw someone out there starting a fire, then in fact some of these were started by people. And it'll be interesting to see if these people actually, a lot of times they make a big court case out of this, but then they slide the people out the back door after they're convicted and supposedly doing time. They're slid out, moved from jail to jail, and then released on with a separate identity. So, and that's a lot of people think that that's what happened to Tim McVeigh, for example, who was working with the government when this whole federal building in Oklahoma City came down. That some people, there are people who claim that Tim McVeigh is still alive. That years later he was working in the Philippines and other places as a secret, you know, a person given a different identity and completely out of the public eye. So anything is possible. And remember last week I talked about the human identity corruption or manipulation, where they have people that, and they've been doing this, of course, for a long time, making up credentials for kids, creating fake people, taking real people, and then giving them another identity and saying, well, that person died or whatever. So anyway, it's really a little strange today. And especially, by the way, my read on some of this protest that occurred this past week, 20 people standing in a parking lot with little microphones and a little PA system and getting wall-to-wall national coverage is ludicrous. It just shows you how twisted what we call the mainstream media is, to take something that was a non-story and blow it up because they want to peg white people as white supremacists and racism and all of this stuff. And, you know, I know a lot of people, and quite frankly, everybody I meet, and I meet a lot of people, just daily life, moving around, doing what I do, and I meet people, and they're very nice, they're very down to earth, they have both feet on the ground, they're very rational, they're not racist, they're not any of the things that they're being called today. So, and understand that there are a lot of these groups, these appear like nutso on TV. These people are paid actors. They're out there to create havoc, and they know they're being protected. But these people are being paid. This is a job. They're getting paid to do this, to make a lot of noise. And quite frankly, the groups are becoming smaller and smaller. And the fact that only 20 people showed up to this one, and, you know, a few hundred other people that were supposedly protesting them. And, you know, if I were the news media, I'd say, well, there's got to be something more important going on. And just another comment. Well, no, I'm not going to go into politics or any of that type of thing. So let me grab a couple other notes here. Here is the situation that is becoming very visible. The plan before was that, Hillary Clinton should win. But, you know, a lot of people think, oh, politics or, you know, things like this. You have to understand, these people represent a very fascist regimes in the background. Things that you don't see, things that you would never see, except eventually they're going to start to affect you. Like eventually they found out about militarizing the IRS against certain groups and people. That came out. That is the thing I'm talking about, and that's going on today, where groups are targeting. Now, these are groups that have access to your internet accounts. They have access to your, to hacking and things like that. Normal people they're starting to track normal people. And if people are vocal, then those people are scrutinized. They're followed. They're put basically on lists because they know eventually to bring down the United States, which is a requirement before there can be a new world, worldwide government. They have to bring down the United States, and they can't bring down the United States as long as there are independent voices out there. And so what they do is what they do best. They try and destroy people's lives. They go after them in petty little ways a lot of times. You know, preventing them from doing normal everyday things. I saw this in the radio world where radio talk show hosts, their families would be targeted and their ability to just perform everyday functions. So anyway, I just want to mention that briefly because most of you out there, you know, you're living your life, you're busy, you're doing your job, etc. But I will make a bit of a comment about people who are socialists. And I have a very good solution to the whole problem, whether you're for socialism and, say, free education and free Medicare for everybody, say you're for that, and then other people are not. Here is the perfect way to resolve this issue, is that everybody who's a socialist and wants free education and a free guaranteed salary, etc., okay, you get your president and your Congress and your taxation, etc., and the people who don't want that have their type of basically taxation, the way taxation is spent. But what you'd find out very quickly is the people who are socialists, they would learn very quickly that everybody who voted for them doesn't have a job. And so they go, well, wait a minute, we need all these other people to pay for our social programs because none of us have jobs. And so that's where it would end up, but it'd be one way to cure it. And you would realize in short order that the people who would vote for that are the people who would benefit from all the freebies. So they can sit there and not do anything. The people who work and pay their taxes and, you know, are trying to buy a house and trying to live and take care of their families, etc., they don't want social programs. They don't want things handed to them because they know that ultimately when money, let's say there's $10, you send that $10 off to Washington, about 3 cents of it comes back to you. So the benefits that come back allegedly from Washington are not free. They're very costly. And anybody who has half a brain would figure that out. The only person that benefits is the guy that doesn't want to work. So you have the two groups, and this is the way I see it. You have the people at work, made a living, worked hard, etc., and then you have the people who don't work, don't want to have a job, don't want to take care of themselves, and those are the people that want the free things because they don't work. They want it just kind of handed to them, and that does not work. Giving stuff for free to people does not work. And I started out with pretty much nothing in my life. And it makes you very economical. It makes you understand about money. You know, here's how much money you have. That's all you can do. It makes you work much smarter. And that's why government programs are typically failures, because they throw all this money at a program and most of it gets wasted. Most of it is not really well spent. Whereas if you have a company, you have to take your money and plan it out, because there's not an infinite supply. You have to be very wise. You have to be very shrewd. You have to be very, you have to take into consideration a lot of aspects, because you only have so much money to deal with. So successful companies are run like a very tight operation. That's the only way they can operate. Even big corporations like GE is feeling the pangs of being an overbloated company. Even though they've been around, they build nuclear submarines, they build nuclear power plants, they build all kinds of high-tech equipment for government programs. But even they are feeling the pinch of economic pinch. Because you can grow in too many directions and not be able to support it. So my solution to the all of the rhetoric going on today is that the socialists, the people that want to vote, and the other thing is that you have people coming out who are very young, you know, in their 20s, and they're going, oh, look at socialism. And let me take an example. They use very rudimentary arguments, like if we just took all of this money over here and we put it in social programs, then everything would be better. But let me see, if you wanted to take all the money out of the military, this was the Lyndon Johnson program, remember? Guns and butter, or butter and guns, I forget which it was. But it was like, oh, we can have both butter, which was all of the welfare programs, and military, you know, the support of the big support at that time was the Vietnam War. But believe me, Trump is doing something that is very interesting. In a typically, in what you'd call a peacetime economy, the military suffers. He is packing their plate full. And there's a good reason for that, because if you are, who, I don't care what president is in office, if you start to slight the military, then, hey, they just go out and the bankers go out and start a war. And so what are you going to get? You're going to get military support no matter what. So anybody who thinks they're going to take the money from military and put it into social programs is dreaming, because it isn't going to happen. It's never happened in the history of the world. So the solution is you give the military their money, you end up with a strong defensive military, and then also strike up the band with the regular economy. But in terms of socialism, as I said, you can give all the logical arguments that it doesn't work and try and point to countries, etc. But the reality is that for a country like the United States, you have people that don't want to work. If you just gave them everything, they would sit there and take it and expect to be privileged and have that as an endowment, like you owe that to them. So the only solution is, well, gee, you're just not going to get anything unless you go out and work. And you'll hear a lot of grumbling, etc. But that's why a lot of kids today are living in grandma's basement, because, you know, there are now jobs. Right now there are 600,000 empty jobs looking for people in the United States. So everybody can go out and work. If somebody's not working, it's because they don't want to work. And that also pushes up, so there is employment in all levels. And I know lots of professional people who are in demand, whether they're doctors, attorneys, or dentists, or engineers. There's a tremendous need for engineering and physics and math, etc. So at any rate, I'm going to stop talking about that, but I think it's very important to understand that socialism, I love these ideas. I think that free college, etc., would be good, but what they found in countries where they did this is that the students would become professional students. They would go to school and go to school and go to school because they kept reapplying and getting more money. So they became professional students. And that's what would happen. And they live on very little because, you know, the stipends for student are not much. But they found a way to sleep in a corner and eat a bowl of rice and an egg on it. And life is good for them. No, there's no ambition there, but that's not producing productive people. And if people don't want a job, then go out and create a job. Go create your own job, like I did. I'm not employed by someone today. I have been employed in my life, but I created my own everything I'm doing here. And people listen, and if they don't want to listen, they can turn off the radio. Okay, tonight's main science topic. This is directed at big people, adults. Call them big people because they're generally bigger than kids. But this is mainly directed at kids And I want to tell you what I did when I was growing up, and I still do it. I still go through this exercise frequently. You take a blank piece of paper. You sit down, no distractions, and you try to target your interests. Are you interested in painting, being in a rock band? Do you want to study science? Do you want to be an engineer? Do you want to be part of the space program? Do you just want to take it easy? Maybe you live in a small town. You like all your friends there, and you want to stay there, and get married, have a family, live a very simple life, and go every weekend to softball, and figure out what you want to do. Because you only have this life you've been given a tremendous gift to have a spirit and a life and feelings and intelligence and everything. And even if you have handicaps, there are ways, in fact, we all have handicaps of some kind. We're not all created equal. There's, in a sense, in the sense of civil liberties, yeah, we're all created equal, but in terms of physical attributes, we are not all created equal. That's just the way it is. So what you can do with what you've been given and also, what do you want to do? How do you want to spend your life? What's going to make you happy? You have to sit down and outline this, and you write it down, and then you look at that occasionally. Do you want to start programs? Like there was a time when I wanted to start a program with telescopes, where I would buy very nice telescopes, and this was when they were first becoming automated, and we had the internet, it was just beginning to flourish, and it was very crude at the time, but I wanted to get telescopes and put people online with them and sell telescope time. And these are not just little telescopes, it's like 32-inch telescopes, and people would be able to rent them and use them, and then other people would be able to see what they're doing, and then just like an open capability, because not everybody can buy a 32-inch telescope, professional grade, with all the equipment and the cameras and computerized and tracking, and that's a boatload of money and investment. And your average person can't do that. But if you could, for a few $100, rent us some time on that, or if you had, say, an astronomy club, and say you wanted to look at Comet K2, which is coming into the solar system, and you wanted to just track that. So once every 2 months, you would rent some time on the telescope and see what's going on with Comet K2. Okay, that was something I particularly wanted to do, but I never could do it because it would be a full-time operation. It would cost a lot of money, which I did not have. But eventually, what I did is I dropped the seed out there, and eventually people that listened to me picked up and did that as a business. So, that it was something that I personally could not do. And a lot of times, if your dreams are really big like that, then, of course, money, etc., is important. You could become a user of those type of facilities. And let me take another example. When I was young, when I first got out of college, it was difficult times at that time because the Vietnam War was raging, and I was myself, explain what I did. I decided myself, I had done very well in physics, mathematics, I had 3 graduate school appointments that I could have gone to, and I decided that I was not ready for that. It was just like, okay, I'd really had worked very hard for those 4 years, college, done very well, had nearly a straight A average in math and physics, double major, And, you know, I was ready to go to grad school, and I thought, you know, I'm just not ready. I got to do something else with my life that's just interesting. So I called up the school where I had accepted the offer to go to grad school there, and I said, look, you know, I'm just not ready. I need to go do something else so I can, I'll come back eventually. And they said, we will keep your appointment for a period of 3 years. We think you're worth it. We want you to come back here. So I thought, wow, that relieves me of going immediately into grad school in physics, and I can go do something else, just find something interest. So I went to, that's when I went to Mexico. And I eventually, I won't go into all the details there, but I had a professional position within a couple months of being in Mexico. I was hired to do teaching. And then also on my own, I taught the kids of the very rich people there. I'd met people, and I would go out to their houses, and I would, you know, you'd go, the guard would let you in the house, the maid would let you in the front door, the guard was at the front gate. These were very wealthy people, and they were international in scope. They were from all countries of the world, and I taught their kids. I tutored them in math and physics. And so anyway, that was like a side business for me. It was a very, very lucrative business. And so anyway, that allowed me time and money. Then what I did is I traveled around. I thought, wow, this country is amazing. Mexico is an amazing, amazing country. What's going on now with all the crime is just horrific. But at that time, Mexico always has been somewhat of a dangerous country to be in. But I traveled around, and I always felt like I had about 10 guardian angels around me at all times. And I got through some very trying situations, let's put it that way, out in the countryside. But I traveled all over Mexico and for about a year and a half. And then I came back to the United States and was like, wow, that was an experience, because that's where I learned the Mayan ruins, the Aztecs. That's where I understood about the Incas. A lot of things happened because of my diverting my attention. And that's one of the objections I have with a lot of people in academia, is that they've never done anything. I talked about this last week. They went to school, they got good grades. They went to college, they got good grades. They went to grad school, they got good grades. They got a PhD. They got hired at Cornell University or someplace. And they've never... They've never had their nose outside of a textbook. They don't know anything. They've never been any place. You know, or maybe they went to Cancun in a 5-star hotel or, you know, whatever. But they have no clue what goes on in the rest of the world. So you cannot be an expert in the world if you've never been out in the world. So anyway, it's very important. The reason I'm talking about this is because this is what I did with my life. And a lot of times I was not, I really didn't know why I was doing everything that I did. And actually it was many years and sometimes decades later that I really realized some of the importance of what I did. As a thing that happened to me when I was in Mexico, I had gone to Tulum, and I was spending Christmas time in Tulum, and this is before the road was just put in there. There were no hotels, there was no Cancun per se, there was Isla Mujeres, but there was no hotels or anything like that. So basically I was camping in the jungle, swimming every day out to the barrier reef and getting conchs and fish to eat, and living off of coconuts because there was a big coconut grove down the road. And, you know, that's what I was doing. I was studying the Mayan ruins. Later, I went back decades later and surveyed those ruins to find that they were offset and that the old North Pole was in the state of the province of Ontario. So it helped me decades later. I went back. And the other thing is a story I like to tell. There was still a indigenous tribe of Lacandon Indians out in the jungle. And so I went out there and walked the path until I came to the little town. And I came into there was like a little store there. And so I went in and I met some of the people. And these guys befriended me, these men, Lacandon Indians. They're all very short. The women were about 3.5 feet tall. They looked like little birds. And they wanted me to join them in drinking their homemade, basically, maguey, which is a liquor they make from cactus. Anyway, I was not really... It was like drinking gasoline. I had some, but it was not like I could partake in that. But anyway, I went into this store, and there's a lady there. She's standing, and they had a little counter. And up above her head was a quetzal bird, which is a bird of paradise. So I'm standing there, I'm looking, I'm talking to her. She didn't speak Spanish. I didn't speak Lacandon. And I'm looking at this bird up above her head, beautiful, big, long tail, and it was perched up there. And the quetzal bird flies, roosts during the daytime and flies in evening and at night. And so anyway, I didn't really know that much about it at the time. And so anyway, it was about sundown, and this bird opens up its wings and flies right over my head with his wings outstretched and his big long tail, bird of paradise. And I looked underneath and I could see that the coloration on the underside of the plumage, which you could only know if you were standing exactly where I was at this time, this bird flying over me, and I could see the shape of a comet. And it didn't register until decades later that I understood that Quetzalcoatl was the plumed serpent god of the night sky, and the quetzal bird was representative. That's where they got the name from, because the quetzal bird is a bird of paradise from that region where the Mayans lived. And so the Quetzalcoatl was the plumed serpent god of the night sky that was the comet. And so they got that name from the quetzal bird. And I would not have known that if I wouldn't have been there at exactly that moment. And so when you're wandering around the world and basically following, you know, I feel that most of my life, somebody was directing me. Go here. Be here now. Do this. And I didn't really know why. And much of my life is like that. Because I think that if you dedicate your life to knowledge and understanding understanding the universe, it's going to open up to you in ways that you never imagined. And that's what happened to me. So I'm just saying this because the world is a big place. And if you're going to study science, for example, I would, as a young person, go out into the wilderness for days, sometimes weeks at a time. There were times when I would be gone into the wilderness for a month or more, just myself, and living off of berries and fish and other things that I would gather, take some amount of food with me, but I couldn't take all the food for that amount of time, to eat three times a day. But live out in the wilderness. And when you do that, you see things that you would never, ever see, and you experience things. You contact nature, and nature contacts you, and you start to understand that nature is an amazing thing. You also understand that there's no way that evolution could create everything that we see. Evolution is just such a kind of a it's a story that only accounts for the very rudimentary, if it accounts for anything at all, only accounts for very rudimentary issues. It does not account for the all of the aspects of humans that make us humans. Think about that. The human being, all of the aspects that make us human are not part of evolution. Evolution doesn't explain how a monkey evolving into a human, and all of a sudden we have all of these properties like feelings and differences of opinion. And this is the type of thing I realized when I was out in nature. When Darwin looked at what he called the evolution of the species, he went to, for example, one of his big influential locations was a small island chain out in the Pacific Ocean, currently owned by Ecuador. And what he noticed were the lizards and the birds, etc., were different than the ones that you saw in the mainland, because he had just been in Peru. He had spent some time on the Peruvian coast. And so he got this idea that animals changed. You know, so he then developed the idea of species that modified based on habitats. Some birds had a longer bill because that was beneficial for, you know, pecking a certain land crab or something, whatever it was. But then he made a leap of faith and said that the species were being created in this manner. And so when you look at the Darwinian concept of evolution, there's a big leap of faith in there. There are other examples of this type of thing in science. But then to say that, oh, man evolved from the monkey, and the monkey evolved from this, and pre-hominid, and then come from lizards, and from bugs, and from little amoeba things, and back to the first cells, and to try and make that statement, there are lots of leaps of faith in there, and it's not scientific. And that's why they keep looking for the missing link. So I realized when I was out in the wilderness that evolution did not, by any stretch of the imagination, account for what we see in nature. And it does not account for what we see in the heavens either. This idea that it evolved from a big bang, from a single explosion, is ludicrous. You know, there are so many gaps and missing holes, missing links in that story. It's not funny. But if they can put it in a textbook and pound it down your throat and make you believe that and repeat that, well, then, see, somebody's going to get a job out of that, and they're not going to let anybody say any different. I'm out of time. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.